On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with Princeton neuroscientist Dr. Michael Graziano about his book, Consciousness and the Social Brain.
Name one who's published anything in the near-death experience literature, the out-of-body experience literature. I've interviewed tons. You can look on the website. None of them have any knowledge.
Yeah, but the problem is that literature is I'm sure if you go to people, I'm sure if you go to astrologers, that you would get a unanimous account of how astrology is valid.
Michael, you're saying Bruce Grayson at the University of Virginia is studying astrology. Jan Holden at University of North Texas. When I interview Stuart Hameroff at University of Arizona, he's well-versed in the near-death experience literature. It's published in peer-reviewed journals. It's not astrology. He feels a need to address it. I Google your name and near-death experience, there's nothing. And now I mention it to you, and you bring out this astrology thing. I mean, that's insulting on your part to not know of this research.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and this week, as you just heard, I'm joined by Princeton University neuroscientist Dr. Michael Graziano. This is one of those interviews that I think is best left without a lot of introduction, so let's get right to the dialogue.
Today we welcome Michael Graziano to Skeptico. Dr. Graziano is a neuroscientist at Princeton University with a long list of academic publications and many important scientific journals. He's also published popular books on the brain like God, Soul, Mind, Brain, and his latest, which we'll talk about, Consciousness and the Social Brain. He's also somewhat of a Renaissance man, having published several noteworthy novels and some rather amazing chamber music that you can check out on his website as well. Dr. Graziano, it's a great pleasure to have you on Skeptico. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Dr. Graziano, you have a new book that came out last year titled Consciousness and the Social Brain. Quite provocative, a new theory on consciousness. Tell us a little bit about the book and this new theory of yours.
Sure. Well, the book really lays out this theory, and it's an entirely rationalist theory. It's a scientific theory of consciousness. And in this way, it diverges from a lot of other theories of consciousness that are out there. I would say that almost all past theories, even the ones that scientists are putting forward, that neuroscientists are putting forward, somewhere along the line deal in magic. A lot of those people wouldn't like to admit to that, I'm sure. But in the end, the question that's asked is typically, how does a brain produce a non-physical magic, an inner magical experience? And that's a very difficult question to answer. And what we're doing is really addressing the question in an entirely different way. We think that, we know from neuroscience that the brain is really an information processing device. And when an information processing device introspects, that is to say, when it accesses internal data, and on that basis concludes and reports that it has a magical property inside of it, really the first question you would ask as a scientist is probably not, how did it produce actual magic? Really, the first question you might want to ask is, how did it produce that self-description? And what's the use? Is there some adaptive advantage to describing itself that way? Or what are the circuits that compute that information? Or how did it evolve? How did that kind of self-description evolve over evolutionary time? So these are the kinds of questions we're trying to get at. They're very much in the domain of information processing. They're objectively studyable, and we think we've made quite a lot of interesting progress in that direction.
Tell us, summarize for us some of the progress you think you've made and why this theory offers a new and better vantage point to ask some of these questions?
Well, one of the things that I think people run into in science or in any attempt to understand ourselves or even the world around us, the brain constructs models of things. It's one of the things brains do. They construct informational descriptions or models of things. And in fact, we understand the world around us and in us solely through those models. We don't really have direct access to the world around us. And the brain's models are notoriously inaccurate. And there's many, many examples of that. Probably the most famous example is the color white. We see white light as pure brightness without any color, because the visual system in the brain constructs that kind of a simplified model. And we know that's physically wrong. White light is a mixture of all colors. We don't see it that way because our internal model describes it in a kind of quick and dirty, simplified way as pure brightness with no color. Now, that's just one example, but pretty much every model of the world, external or internal, that the brain constructs is sketchy, cartoonish, a little bit faulty, and that means our intuitions are at the mercy of those models. So when we start introspecting and asking ourselves, how do I explain my internal experiences, that gets very tricky introspectively, because we're relying on these informational models that are likely to be incorrect. So what we're trying to do is take a much more objective or outside view of the process. So what we think is going on in a nutshell, so I talked about one of the things brains do. They make models of things. Another talent brains have, you might say, is paying attention to things. And by attention, I mean something very specific. And it's a difficult word because it has so many different meanings, colloquial meanings, and so on. But I mean something very specific from a neuroscientist's point of view. Attention is, there's so many signals coming in at the same time, a brain can't process them all, and it selects some for deeper processing. So now we have these two kinds of processes going on in the brain. One, the brain constructs models of things that are useful to keep track of. And number two, the brain focuses its resources on some signals. And you might ask, what happens inevitably when the brain combines those two talents? What happens if the brain builds one of these simplified models to describe its own process of paying attention to things? Right? And we think this is what awareness is, to be aware of something. First, a brain pays attention to it. And second, the brain builds its own kind of sketchy, you might say almost cartoonish model of what it means for it to pay attention to that thing. And then that brain is in a position, has the information to say, to report, I am aware of that thing. And so that, you know, in a nutshell, that's the theory. I've often said it's a very easy theory to explain. It's much harder to explain why it's a good theory. Because there's such a range of material out there in the literature that links up to it.
Sure, sure. Kind of like poker. Easy to learn, hard to master, huh? So
that's right.
I want to jump back for a minute, though, to this idea of the assumption of magic, which understandably riles up a lot of people. And I think the pushback that a lot of people would give and probably have given, Michael, is that, aren't you just kind of jumping past the really hard stuff? I mean, here's the deal. There is this thing called consciousness. So you can say you're assuming it's magic, you're assuming it's not, but we still have to deal with it. So aren't we just jumping past the existence of consciousness? And if you want to go scientific, I'd say, great, no magic. Let's start with the first step. Okay, Dr. Graziano, tell us what's necessary and sufficient to create consciousness. That would be like a first logic, rationalist kind of thing. What's necessary and sufficient to create human consciousness?
Well, you know, one way to put it, and I've often used this example because it kind of nicely encapsulates our approach, and it is totally different, certainly totally different from the perspective that you outlined that I think a lot of people take. So here's an example. I had a friend, he was a psychologist, and he told me about a patient of his. And this patient had a delusion. He thought he had a squirrel in his head. And, you know, that's a little odd, but people have odd delusions. It's not that unusual. Anyway, he was certain of it, and you could not convince him otherwise. He was fixed on this delusion. He knew it to be true. Now, you could tell him that's illogical, and he would say, yeah, that's okay, but there are things in the universe that transcend logic. You could not argue him out of it. So there are kind of two directions you could take in trying to explain this phenomenon, and one would be to ask, okay, how does his brain produce a squirrel? How do the neurons secrete the squirrel? Now, that would be a very unproductive approach. And another approach would be to say, well, how does his brain construct that self-description? And how does it arrive at such certainty that the description is correct? And how does the brain not know that it's a self-description? Now, those things you can get at from an objective point of view. You can answer those questions. And in effect, what I think, you can replace the word squirrel with the word awareness. And I think the whole thing is exactly encapsulated. I think almost all approaches to consciousness take the first direction. How does a brain produce a squirrel? It doesn't.
I guess I'd roll back to the first assumption, which is embedded in that, which is that, you know, a well-functioning brain creates consciousness. Or even before that, you know, evolution creates brain creates consciousness. And I'd say, right, let's start there, because you are assuming that. You're saying that that is one thing that's necessary to create consciousness, is a well-functioning brain. And then I'd say, you know, forget
that. I think you're missing, though. Evolution creates brain. I do not think brain creates consciousness. I think brains create information, and the information informs us of something that's actually not physically correct. And as a result, we arrive at this conclusion that we have consciousness, and we're captive to that. Brains only know the information available to them. So we're captive to the information generated by our brains generated within their models. We're captive to that. So if a brain has a model that tells it, you're an elephant, or you have a squirrel in your head, that brain is captive to that information. It can't escape that. And likewise, if brains have information in them that says you have this inner experience, then we're captive to that information. I don't think we need to explain how brains produce the inner experience. The thing to be explained is how, and for what adaptive advantage, brains construct the information that they have an inner experience.
But don't we kind of get into a matter of semantics there? I mean, you are assuming that a brain, a well-functioning brain, is necessary to produce everything else in that chain. You say the models that produce the information, that produce the consciousness, you are starting with a well-functioning brain. So that is a necessary part of the equation for you, right?
Yes, but I would still, I do not buy the word produce attached to the word consciousness. I don't think brains produce consciousness any more than that delusional man's brain produced a squirrel.
Again, that's kind of semantics, right? So you're saying brains produce models, brains process information, and then that, you know, creates this. Well, again, that's kind of a semantic kind of little game there that we're playing, in terms of, at the end, we have this experience that we all call consciousness. So I'm just go back to the first thing. Here, let me throw something out that kind of throws a wrench into this. Jeffrey Schwartz, MD, research psychiatrist, UCLA School of Medicine. A few years ago, he writes a book titled You Are Not Your Brain. Here's his experiment. It's amazingly straightforward, but extremely important. He gets a group of these people. They have OCD, the classical, you know, have to knock three times before they enter the door, all that kind of stuff. So he's trying to help these people. He's trying to treat these people. So he says, okay, take that awareness that we're talking about, take that awareness and do this. Focus it this way. Gives them some meditation techniques, right? And he does an fMRI of their brain before, and he does it after. And I have to say, this research has been repeated in various ways for a number of years, all over the place. But he's the first guy to really hone in and say, okay, look, after this attention thing, awareness thing, the brain is a different brain, which at the very least, it throws a huge monkey wrench in your theory, in that now we have to ask, what brain are we talking about? Are we talking about the brain before the thought or after the thought? And then if we keep rolling that chicken and the egg thing back, we say, well, if thoughts shape the physical structure of the brain, and the physical structure of the brain is this building block for this whole thing, however you want to call it, the consciousness thing, then we have a big chicken and the egg problem, and we keep rolling it back, and we say, well, what came first, the thought or the brain?
Yep, sorry, don't see how that throws monkey wrenches into the approach we're taking, but it's a very interesting point. And certainly, thinking changes the brain, and the brain functioning changes the brain. That is certainly true, and it's well known. In fact, you can do something like practice up a skill, and your brain maps change accordingly. You can have a thought, and it changes the activity patterns and the connectivity in your brain. This is certainly true.
So what comes first? What comes first, the thought or the brain?
I'm not 100% sure what you mean by that. I would say that
a thought changes the brain, changes the physical structure of the brain, and we keep rolling that back in the brains prior to ours. There was a thought, and that changed the brain. How do we ever get back to the starting point of the brain before the thought?
Right. I think what you're doing is making the assumption that the thought is a separate kind of metaphysical thing that, when it happens, causes a change in the brain, as opposed to there's a computer, and it processes information, and in the act of processing information, it changes its own states.
Well, again, that's what the research from Dr. Schwartz indicates, and that's why he wrote the book, You Are Not Your Brain. But
right. So, but that research show anything other than when the brain functions, it changes. And we all knew that for the last 100 years. So I'm sure that that's an interesting study, but I don't see how it addresses the duality question.
Okay. Well, it does get to this attention issue, but you know what? Let's kind of move on beyond that, because one thing I wanted to mention is that in addition to your academic work at Princeton, you also publish on popular sites, which I think is great. I mean, you're an academician and you're, you know, highly skilled in this research, but you write stuff that everyone can read. I read a post of yours on the Huffington Post titled "Consciousness and the Unashamed Rationalist." Go ahead, tell us what that means to be an unashamed rationalist.
I think that in this study of consciousness, there is a certain squeamishness toward the most rationalist scientific approach. There is, I sense, a desire to maintain mystery, maybe partly because if the mystery is cleared up, the field of consciousness studies goes away, and that's, you know, a whole line of work that many people rely on. Or maybe there are personal reasons or emotional reasons or religious reasons why people love this notion of an unexplainable mystery. And my approach to this is entirely mechanistic, entirely rationalist. And the question I'm asking, in a sense, is how far can we go in an entirely rationalist approach? How far can we get and be able to explain as much as possible? And I think that kind of is the mission of science. You know, not to explain everything, because I don't think that will ever happen, but to see how much can be explained, and in particular, to see how much can be explained by entirely rational and mechanistic means and testable means, to give a shot at that. And that's kind of the mission of science. That's how I approach this question of consciousness. So that's kind of what I mean by the unashamed rationalist.
Good. And I'm glad you brought up the issue of spirituality and religion, because you touch on it a couple of times, and I'm not really exactly sure where you're coming from. On page 58 of your book, Consciousness and the social brain, you write, the question of where the soul is located becomes complicated with out-of-body experiences. I want to break that down in a couple of ways. First of all, tell us about a little bit more about this soul thing and why you think these questions of religion and spirituality intersect with consciousness. One, do they at all, and why do they?
Mm-hmm. Well, one point, I think that scientists do themselves and the rest of us a disservice when they shy away from religion. A lot of scientists just treat it as something kind of icky and don't want to address it and decide if the word religion is somewhere in there, then they'll just leave it alone. The problem is that religion is a huge part of humanity. It's a huge part of who people are. It has a giant impact on us culturally. It's a creative driving force, an emotional and social driving force. And as an actual real life phenomenon, human religion, it deserves scientific study. So that's one point I would make. It's something
Wait a minute. How does that intersect with consciousness? I'm with you. And we've done dozens of shows on Christianity and cultish thinking and how that happens and all the rest of that. But I don't see the intersection between religion and consciousness. And in fact, I think it really muddies the water when we kind of bring in this phony science versus religion debate that doesn't really add anything to the scientific questions.
Well, one of the key points in this theory that we're building is that you can ask, what do we use awareness for? And of course, most of us think of awareness, consciousness, as a private phenomenon, but we use it socially. We attribute awareness to other people. It's one of the ways we use this whole concept of awareness. So I talk to you over the phone and I get a strong sense that you're a being with an awareness and a consciousness. And this is very critical for any kind of social interaction. In fact, without it, we wouldn't be a successful species because we rely on this intense social ability, the ability to intuit what's going on in someone else's mind on the basis of very fleeting cues, almost instantaneously. And what I think is happening is that it's this same ability, ability not only to attribute awareness to ourselves and to the people around us, but think of all the other ways we attribute awareness. Well, to our pets, of course, or children attribute awareness to their stuffed animals. We get mad at the coffee machine when it doesn't work. We attribute, in animistic societies, attribute awareness and consciousness to trees and rivers. And I would say that it's exactly the same process that leads people to attribute awareness to empty spaces and around them and to the events around them. And from that flows some of the kind of core basics of religion, these beliefs in spirits that are separate from bodies that explain, for example, the behavior of the world, the storms or the rains or everything in the universe that's otherwise inexplicable that is attributed to a deity. So there is a thread running through religion that at its root has to do with our extraordinary social capability of building models of minds and attributing them to the things and the spaces around us. And that's the link.
Yeah, I don't know, Michael. That's tenuous. I mean, you run into the same problem that we criticize Christian apologists for. I mean, you're beginning with the end and working backwards, saying, okay, I know all about this experience that people are having, so let me go ahead and explain it from my rationalist perspective. I think it just complicates things and creates this big mess. I'd go back to this quote of yours that I read. I mean, let's focus in on the data a little bit, because you said the question of where the soul is located becomes complicated with out-of-body experiences. Aha, now here's an experience we can really hone in on. We can really look at the data and see how it fits these different theories. And then you go on to say that these out-of-body experiences are an illusion, and you make this passing reference to Olaf Blank's research where he stimulated this part of people's brain and they had some aspects of an out-of-body experience, which I have to tell you, I've talked to a lot of very credible, well-published academic researchers who've researched OBEs and have researched near-death experience science, and none of them think very highly of Blanc's research in terms of coming anywhere close to really replicating these kind of experiences. But moreover, the big thing about it is, you know, it's I want to hear what you mean when you say it's complicated with out-of-body experience. Because I think, heck yes, it's complicated. It's complicated because here we have these people who in the case of near-death experience, let's look at, they have a non-functioning brain, which we both agreed was kind of the starting point for this whole chain of events that lead to consciousness. I won't say create consciousness because I know you don't like that, but lead to the creating of models and processing of information. Here we have these people, they no longer have a functioning brain, and yet they do have this experience of processing information. I interviewed Dr. Jeff Long. I don't know if you know these guy, know this guy, but comprehensive study of near you know him?
Nope, sorry.
A comprehensive survey of 2,000 of these people who've had these near-death experiences. Detailed records of their recollections during their out-of-body experience, and they're accurate. Interviewed
Dr. Penny Sartori.
Also Jan Holden at University of North Texas. Both did similar research independently, where they took these people, they had a cardiac arrest, and they had an out-of-body experience, and they go to them. Again, it's pretty simple, say, what do you remember about your resuscitation? Again, we have the non-functioning brain, and we have the people who have the out-of-body experience have much more statistically significant, accurate details of their resuscitation than the other group that didn't. So we have all this evidence that keeps pointing to that, yeah, it's really complicated with out-of-body experiences, because unlike that little experiment that Blanc did that's kind of hokey stimulating the back, we have a lot of evidence that these people with these non-functioning brains are still having these rather dramatic experiences.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess I could say equally, I've talked to an awful lot of experts in neuroscience who are quite impressed with the Blanc experiment and who do consider it to be a classic out-of-body experience.
Name one who's studied, who's published anything in the near-death experience literature, the out-of-body experience literature. I've interviewed a bunch of them. I've interviewed tons. You can look on the website. None of them have any knowledge. Hey, I'll tell you this. I do a Google search of
Dr. But the problem is that literature is I'm sure if you go to people, I'm sure if you go to astrologers that you would get a unanimous account of how astrology is valid. I think maybe a little bit of this is going on here with respect to
Michael,
the NDE.
Michael, you're saying Bruce Grayson at the University of Virginia is studying astrology. Jan Holden at University of North Texas. Even when I interview Stuart Hameroff at University of Arizona, he's well-versed in the near-death experience literature. It's published in peer-reviewed journals. It's not astrology. He's well-versed in it. He feels a need to address it. I Google your name and near-death experience, there's nothing. And now I mention it to you, and you bring out this astrology thing. I mean, that's insulting on your part to not know of this research.
That could be. I mean, I'm aware there's an NDE world out there. I would say that it's very, very difficult, and I'm very skeptical of the claim that the brain is actually non-functioning. It's almost impossible to demonstrate that there's no functioning, no activity in a brain. It's almost impossible. I just don't believe that there are the scanning methods available to arrive at that kind of conclusion. Of course, these brains are functioning. If these people are having experiences, their brains are in some manner functioning.
Michael, you're a neuroscientist. I mean, I think you should be more well-versed. Anyone, this is basic. I spoke with one of the world's leading experts on EEG, and I've also spoke with other ones, and they'll tell you point blank, anyone who's had a cardiac arrest within 15 seconds has, we can assume through all the human studies we've done and all the animal studies we've done, that they have a flatline, non-functioning brain. So people can point to some, people point to sometimes to some deep brain activity that might be going on, and a study comes out on rats with this deep brain activity. But none of that matches all the other research we have of what a brain looks like when it's normally functioning and producing this experience that we all talk about. So what you just said is it just doesn't match with the data to just assume that, oh, I know that people have cardiac arrest. Normally, we don't think of their brain as functioning, but you're skeptical, so you have to assume in these situations that the burden's on you to kind of say why we should go against everything we already know.
Yeah, I think the burden's on the NDE people to show us that there's really NDEs, and I think pretty much most of my neuroscience colleagues would conclude that no, there are these experiences. They're related to brain function. There's no mind or experience independent of the functioning of the brain.
Okay, but again, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say one of the cornerstone observations from which all neuroscience emerged is that damage the brain and you damage bits and pieces of the mind. And that observation, you know, from Hippocrates on is, like I said, a cornerstone. It really shows the deep relationship between the functioning of the brain and what we call the mind.
Right, but if I can persist just a little bit, because you keep saying there's this army of neuroscientists who all agree with you that this near-death experience science isn't important because they're making some fatal flaw. And I challenge you to tell me one who has any kind of familiarity with that research, who's published anything about that research. You obviously haven't, so I think you're admitting that you're not familiar with the research. So who is one of your colleagues who we could talk to who really has challenged that research in a more direct way? And I would just cite, like, Dr. Pin von Lommel, somebody we've talked to, publishes this long 10-year study of a cardiologist, 20-year cardiologist in the Netherlands, publishes in The Lancet, right? One of the top medical journals in the country. Tell me who has a substantive counter-argument to the claims that he makes in that paper, right? That's an academic paper that we should take seriously. You're not aware of it. You should be aware of it, but you're not. Tell me one of your colleagues you're talking about who is aware of it, who's published something about it.
I don't know any serious or reputable scientists who have bothered to do experiments to refute psychic phenomena.
We're talking about The Lancet.
Seeing into the future.
We're talking about The Lancet. We're talking about someone who is a cardiologist for 20 years, and you're countering with psychic phenomena?
Yes, exactly. That's what it is. It's a psychic phenomenon.
But you've never examined any of the literature. You've never read any of the literature.
I've read a certain amount of it.
What have you read?
Again,
tell me one that you've read.
There's a large literature on astrology that I wouldn't bother to read.
You can't cite one piece of near-death experience. You cannot cite one piece of near-death experience science literature. I told you Bruce Grayson at the University of Arizona. I cited three or four people who are well-respected academics: Peter Fenwick, Sam Parney at Cornell, and you want to talk about psych. So tell me one that you've read, Michael. One that you've read.
What you're doing is appealing to authority. I'm sorry. It doesn't interest me.
Appealing to authority? I'm talking to a Princeton neuroscientist. Yeah. You are the authority.
Oh, well, in that case, I say that I'm very, very skeptical of... I believe that there are such things as near-death experiences.
Why do you believe that?
Because people report them. But
how do you know they report them? You haven't read the literature.
I believe that they are caused by activity in the brain.
And you base that on what?
Well, my knowledge
of... You haven't read any of the literature, Michael, which is fine. Look, I don't want to pound on you anymore. This your research is really important. Tell us where you're going with this important theory, this attention schema theory at Princeton.
Yes.
Where does this take you in the future?
Well, we continue to put it to experimental test. Every good theory should be falsifiable. We think this one is as well, and it is susceptible to experimental test. And what we've done, having laid out the theory, is begun to test it in specific ways with behavioral experiments on attention and awareness, with imaging studies, putting people in scanners to look at brain areas and isolate the network or parts of the network that seem to be involved in these computations, and with disruption experiments, such as what's called transcranial magnetic stimulation. It's a method of temporarily disrupting neuronal activity in select spots and measuring the effects of that when we target it to specific cortical areas. So we have a very large full plate, you might say, of experiments to do to address this theory, find out what its validity is or is not. And that's kind of the strength of science, is to, as I said, outline falsifiable theories and then put them to the test.
Right. And
that's kind of where we are.
Right. And on your website at princeton.edu, which anyone can find very easily by Googling your name, you have quite a nice, do you keep people regularly updated on things that are going on in your lab?
Well, mostly I update the publication list. And so, and I have links to the publications. So anyone can go look at what the latest publications are on this topic. One just came out in PNAS a month or two ago on this topic of consciousness.
Good. And as I mentioned, you're very out there, public, and write a lot of things that anyone can pick up and read. And again, this latest book of yours, Consciousness and the Social Brain, obviously is on Amazon and all those other places people can find it. It's really been great having you on. I know I had to push you a little bit on some of these hot button issues that we like to talk about, but I do appreciate your openness and willing to dialogue about this. So best of luck with all your work, and thanks again for joining me.
Good. Thank you. I always enjoy a lively conversation, and I think that's
we did offer up that, didn't we?
Yes.
Thanks again to Dr. Graziano for joining me today on Skeptico. As a follow-up to this interview, I'm very happy to say that Dr. Jeffrey Shortz from UCLA Medical School has agreed to join me to talk about one of the small points that we covered in this interview. You know, there's much, much I could say about this interview, but probably not a lot that I haven't said already many times in other shows. The one question I tee up from this interview has to do with Dr. Graziano's reliance on this idea of the emergent property of consciousness, and just what exactly you make of that. So let me know your thoughts on that. Of course, the place to do it is at the Skeptico website. You can find it at skeptiko.com. From there, you can bounce on over to the forum or leave a comment right there in the comment section of the page. You can also drop me an email or connect with me on Facebook. It's always great to hear from folks and hear how their own personal journey with some of this information is going. So I have a number of interesting shows coming up. Not sure what exactly one I'm going to bring to you next, but have an interesting show on healing. And I think I've been sitting on that for a while, and I think that one might be ready to come out. Or as promised, we might hear from Dr. Jeffrey Shortz. So I guess I'll have to keep you guessing a little bit until next episode, but I do hope you'll stick around for all of that. And until next time, take care and bye for now.
Stay with us for Skeptico.